Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, two lines down. The Gemara here is taking up a topic that concluded our previous daf, which is that in a situation where a person says, Kenei kechamor, take possession of this like a chamor, it doesn't work. It fails. It fails because you told the person to take a kinyan like something that doesn't work. And that was the case that we had yesterday, that we concluded in a situation where the father gifted to his previous or older son, similar to the manner that he gifted those unborn children, that we said it fails. It fails because it's kenei kechamor mikoni. If you tell someone to go ahead and do something where the instructions fail, the person you're comparing them to or the instructions you're comparing them to don't work at all, then it's also not going to work for him. And therefore, that individual or that older child there will get nothing. Now, on the second line down, we say, Ditmar, kenei kechamor lo kana. That's the conclusion that we came to yesterday. That is a halacha that's muskemet lakol, that if you tell someone to make a kinyan like a donkey, and a donkey obviously doesn't make a kinyan, then their kinyan doesn't work at all. At vichamor, here is the more complex situation, in a case where he says, you and the chamor take possession of all of my property. So he basically gives all his property to this individual and his donkey. Nachon amar, kana mefsa. You get your half. The donkey, that's his problem. Donkeys don't take possession of anything, but he granted you half of the possessions, so you get your half of the possessions. The donkey is irrelevant. Rav Amnuna amar, lo amar klum. Rav Amnuna, on the other hand, says, just like it fails for the donkey, so too does it fail for you. As the Rashbam says over here, kevan bekinyan echad shitef shnehem. Since he joined them together in a single kinyan, velo nigmara bedato laknot lezeh belo zeh klum. And he wanted it to be a whole package. He created a package, and the package is, you get half, the donkey gets half. Well then, just like the donkey's half fails, so too your half fails. It's not a bifurcate this and take your piece and let the donkey do whatever it does. It's you and the donkey. If that doesn't work with you and the donkey, then it's not going to work at all. And therefore, Rav Amnuna says that we have a failure completely here on the kinyan. So you can see here again, the Rashbam focuses on this idea of gemirat hadat. Again, in yesterday's daf, we saw that the Rashbam said the similar thing with regards to Rava and explaining Rava's position as to why it doesn't work when they went in the first place to take a kinyan on the property of the ger, because in their mind they had a certain safek or they had something there that prevented them from making a full gemirat hadat or a full kinyan. Similarly over here, when he granted it to you, he granted it as a package, and the gemirat hadat will only take place if that works as a whole package. If it doesn't work as a whole package, it fails completely. That's one way to say it. The other possible way to say it is that there's a failure not in the gemira dat of the notain, but there's a failure in the kinyan itself. He's telling you to make a kinyan along with the donkey. Since the donkey can't make a kinyan, so too you can't make a kinyan over here. It's not about gemira dat, but rather about functionally whether there was actually a kinyan or a right given to you here at all in order to make a kinyan. Rav Sheshet Amar, Kanako. Rav Sheshet says, when he gives it to you and the donkey, since the donkey can't do anything, you basically take whatever is left over. It's basically split it between you and the donkey. Well, if the donkey doesn't take anything, then you get everything. So that's the view of Rav Sheshet. So a three-way machloket when you say at v'chamor. So the question really revolves, according to the Rashbam at least, similar to what we said, kineg kichamor, when you say take possession like a chamor, then at v'chamor, does that have a similar ring to it? Which is that you and the donkey should take possession, which means you like the donkey. And that would be Rav Amnuna's view, where he says nothing, similar to the case of kenei kechamor. For Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshet, the question is, what did he mean for you? Obviously, the part of the donkey is meaningless, so we drop that away. When we drop away that part, what does that mean for you? According to Rav Nachman, means you get half, you get 50% of it. According to Rav Sheshet, you get everything. Rav Elchanan and the Kobetz Shiurim explains over here that their machloket between Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshet revolves around how we view the gifting jointly of property. Do we view it that when he gives each party a property, he's giving 50% to this person and 50% to this person? Or is he giving 100% to both parties? And that means that if they're both there, they'll each take 50%. But if one of them is absent, then the other party will fill in and take the entire 100%. So I'm Rav Sheshet, mina min Allah. I'll prove to you that I'm right in this case. It's a similar refrain to what we saw yesterday in the position of Rav Sheshet as well, when he said, echad zeh ve'echad zeh kana, with the ubar, he said, I'm Rav Sheshet, mina min Allah. Where can I prove it to you? So not only is this topically connected in a sidebar that the Gemara is taking because of the fact of Kenei Kechamor, but also you have here a statement from Rav Sheshet and a refrain from Rav Sheshet, which is very similar to what he had said yesterday. The Tanya, we have a Braita. Rav Yossi Omer, Ein lechamar bekishut, ela penimi shibo. The bitter part of the kishut are the inner piece, the center of the kishut. Kishut probably here refers to a zucchini, some sort of gourd. Ein lechamar bekishut, ela penimi shibo. So in the zucchini, the center or the inner part is the bitterest part or is the bitter part. Lefikach, kishut oreim, when he takes off shuma, musif alechitzon shibo. He has to add on from the outer part, vitoreim, and then he takes off truma. So now you're faced with an issue, which, again, the Baalei Tosafot will discuss in 1 second, take this up, because it doesn't seem like it should be such a big deal, that you have, for instance, here, 50 zucchinis, these gourds of some sort, and then you want to take off truma. Truma is 2%. That means that you're going to take off one from the 50 in order to give truma. So our fear is here that if you take off the one and it turns out that that one is bitter, then you have a problem because they come in different forms. They come in a sweet form and they come in a bitter form. And if you take off from the sweet on the sweet, it's fine. On the bitter, it's fine. But if you take off from a bitter truma on the sweet residual, then that's problematic because you're not taking out from the same quote-unquote species. You're not taking it out from the common vegetable here, being mafrish truma. So we want you to get the min bimino. We want you to get the same min. So the fear is that when you take off whatever it is, that's going to have a higher percentage of bitterness to it. The assumption being that the center is bitter and the outer part is sweeter. And that has to do with when it's picked, how ripened it is. There are different factors that contribute to the bitterness and the sweetness. So that means that no two are going to be exactly the same. If you're mafrish over here from this one, we're afraid that you're going to get too much bitter and not enough sweet in that grouping. Rishonim explained both the way that you're suggesting that there's some bitter ones and there's some sweet ones. That's a possibility. Others suggest that even in a single kishot, there is a bitter center to it and a sweeter outer side to it. But the balance between the two is not always the same in every one of them. So when you take off one representative kishut to take truma from the others, you don't know if you're getting the right percentage. So that safek leaves us in a difficult position. So therefore, the suggestion is, lefikach kishutoreim mosif alechitzon shebo. You add on from the outer runs, vitoreim. If you say that it's in a singular unit, then you take more of the outside or extra outside, so that makes sure that you get extra sweet stuff there to make sure that you capture the percentage. If you say that it means that each one of them is different, you'll take a couple extra zucchinis, kishot, in order to make up or be sure that you capture the sweet piece over here. Either way, what you're trying to do is make sure that the percentages balance out. Now, it doesn't make so much sense because generally we have a principle that when you take off truma, if you have a statistical sample that you are looking at, when the probabilities, when you take something out of that statistical sample, is that you'll get something that represents the sample as a whole. So here, when you take off truma, and you're taking one of the items that's there, or according to those that think it's multiple items that you're taking off in order to be toreim and take the truma, then you're right, we don't know what each zucchini looks like. We don't know what each one of them internally, we don't know what they are. But if I take out a sample, if I take out a percentage, the percentage should represent the whole. And therefore, I should have captured whatever it is that I'm worried about in that truma. So if I pick out the zucchini and it's half bitter and half sweet, we can assume that all of the zucchinis as a whole will have some representation that is similar to this zucchini. And therefore, why am I worrying about this? What am I getting all worked up about? That's the question that the Baalei Tosafot asks, because that is generally the way that we deal with it in other situations. We assume that if you take the sample, you take out the truma, that it represents the whole that is there. And if there is some sort of mixture, that sample will be made of the same mixture that the totality is. And so therefore he says, V'nir l'ri, the Rabbi Yossi da'ocha lo ari, shekola kishuim marim, elo utah shetoreim nitzeit mara. So he says that this case is not a case where every kishot, every one of these items is considered to be bitter, but rather the one that he happened to pick out was bitter. He happened to pick one, and then it turns out that that one is bitter. Now, how do you solve the problem? Once you've taken off a bitter kishuim, what do you do now in terms of truma? So everybody agrees there is a knas, that we penalize you, or you have a knas, and we ask you to go back and take off truma. So that's the question about what does that solution entail. So the Rabbanan and Rabbi Yossi say you got to redo it over again. You got to restart from the beginning and take off a sweet one to represent the proper truma to be do it correctly in the first place. Rabbi Yossi polig b'savar, and Rabbi Yossi argues on the Chachamim's solution, which is to go back and take off another truma. The example given there in the Mishnayot in Trumot was a case where benimseit mara avatiach benimse saruach found a watermelon and it turned out to be rotten. So you have this possibility in any grouping that you would take something off, and you figure out after you took off the truma that happens not to be good. So the Chachamim say yachzor v'yitrom. You have to go back and take off the right truma. The penalty, just because we don't want him giving bad stuff to the Kohen, we don't intentionally doing it especially, then whatever the bad stuff is, he gives his truma and he keeps the good stuff for himself. So even though here maybe it wasn't done intentionally, either, but maybe it was a shogeg, he didn't look into it so carefully, or maybe he couldn't have known at all. But in the end, when he finds out, we say the knas is go back and take off additional truma to get sweet stuff, or make sure that you get good stuff here. And Rabbi Yossi disagrees with that solution. He says, Dein tzarich lachzor v'litrom. He doesn't have to go back and take off a whole new truma. Elo mosif min achitzon al achitzon. You just add on from the outside to the outside. Afilo utash nimseit mara, en achitzon mar kol kach. Even the one that you say is bitter, it's made up of different gradations of bitterness. The center is very bitter, but the outer side is sweet. So the outer part of it, at least, can be considered or classified as truma. And then you just add on a little more of outside, or a little more of the truma, sweet stuff, that will cover you. Because it's still negdar ka'ochel, it still has a status of being a food, even when it is bitter. Especially the outer edges of the vegetable, which aren't as bitter as the inner or inside of the vegetable. And so Rabbi Yossi's solution is, go ahead and add on more on top of that which is bitter, and that'll be your truma over here. And he brings a proof from the Yerushalmi that seemingly says something similar to this. Even though it might be bitter, it's still classified as an ochel. And given that, Rabbi Yossi says the solution here is not to have to replace the whole thing and redo the truma again, but simply to add on sweet stuff, or to add on more sweet to the outer part of the vegetable, which is sweet, which will count towards your truma. So that is the case. Either according to the Rashbam and the other Rishonim, it's a case where you are mafrish truma, and you're trying to get the right representative percentage of sweet and bitter, so add on some sweet to make sure you do it. Or according to the Balei Tosafot, where you separated something and it was completely bitter, and it should not have been the truma that you chose. How do I rectify that? According to Rabbi Yossi, I just add on a little more sweet. Now, the reason he brings this down is, Amai. Why does this work? At v'chamor hu. It's the equivalent of you and the donkey that take possession of the item. In this case, the bitter does not work. The sweet does work. When he's mafrish the truma, he's mafrish it as a singular entity. And he takes off the entity and he basically says, all of this is truma. That means both the bitter is truma and the sweet is truma. So how does that work? How does it function if it is at vik chamor? According to Psheshit, he says, I have no problem here. Once you're mafrish it, all the sweet takes over and becomes the whole item. So that's great. That's why it's truma over here. But for especially for Rav Amnuna, he says, lo amar klum, it's a complete failure. According to Rav Nachman, he says, the chetzi, over here, it might work, according to Rav Nachman, because you can say the sweet stuff does work, and that is the truma. Depends on how you explain the Gemara or the Mishnah until now. The bitter part is functioning as truma on the bitter side, or it's not functioning at all as truma, but maybe you could fit it into Rav Nachman. But at least for Rav Sheshit, it is a solid proof to the fact that the truma becomes completely the sweet stuff. Mar says, Shani hotam, demidoraita truma malyotahi. No. You made a mistake here. It's not that the sweet stuff is truma, and the bitter stuff is not truma at all. The bitter stuff does succeed at being truma. It's just a subpar form of truma, which is that midoraita, you're allowed to take off from the bad on the good on the bad, Either way, you don't have to match up exactly the min, except that it's not the right way to do it. Damar Rav Ila, minan torei minara ala yafeh. How do you know if someone takes off truma from the lower quality, the bad stuff, on the good stuff, shitrumato truma, that he is successful at creating the truma? Shenemar, because the pasuk says, v'lo tisu alav chet, v'harimchem et chelbo mimenu, that you should not carry the burden of the iniquity when you take off the fat from it. Im eino kadosh, nisiyot chet, lama. If it is not successful, then why are you carrying any iniquity? Why is there any sin over here? Mikan, from here you see, the torei minara al yafes, someone who takes off from the lower quality, the bad stuff, on the good stuff, shit trumato truma, that he is successful at creating truma. The way the Rashbam explains it, the diuk of the pasuk is, how are you not carrying a chet? How are you not carrying the iniquity? When you take the best, the chelev, you take the fat, the best stuff, off of it. So if you separate the best stuff as the truma, then you won't carry a chet. The implications from that are, if you don't take the best stuff, but you take the bad stuff off, you are going to carry a chet. Then that is the limud that is brought, which is, why should you have a sin if you're unsuccessful at creating truma? If you're unsuccessful at creating truma, then you don't have truma. That's the result of what you did. You didn't do anything wrong. You didn't do any sin because you didn't create truma and you failed completely. On the other hand, if you are successful at creating the truma, but you create a subpar, substandard truma, then I understand why you would be carrying a sin, because you successfully took off truma, but you took off truma that is not the best way to do it. And so that's the limud, that even when you take minara liyafeh, the truma is a good truma, but you will be tisu alav chet. You're going to be carrying the sin or the iniquity of the fact that you didn't take it the right way. So that shows you midoraita, even the bitter stuff would have worked as truma. So since that's the case, anything you do on top of that is really just a knas, is just a fine, and not you saying that I'm taking truma from the bitter and the sweet. The bitter would have worked by itself. The addition of the sweet, according to Rabbi Yossi, or according to Chamim, have to go back and be toreim completely again, is all a knas, because we don't want you doing this, or we don't want you giving the bad stuff to the kohen in the end. But as far as the Torah is concerned, you already discharged your obligation with the bitter stuff. So this is not a case of at v'chamor, because there is no chamor over here. There's no failing truma over here. There is a truma, which is b'diavad, and you have a truma that is v'chatchila. But either way, the truma is truma, and then it's not comparing or putting together one thing that works and one thing that doesn't work. So now, Amar Leih Rav Mordechai the Rav Ashi, Meitiv Rav Avya T'yufta. Rav Avya came up with this strong question, which is from the sugya in Kiddushin, which is Maaseh b'chamesh nashim. It's a case with five women, ubehen shtei achayot. Amongst those five women are two sisters. V'liket echad, an individual, a man, went ahead and he collected a basket full of figs. Vel shelahen haita, and it was from the women's field. Vel shel shvi'it haita, but it was the Shemitah year. So here, the Gemara in Kiddushin is midayek out of the story, a number of halachot. The Rashbam himself over here brings the three things learnt out from the nature of the story, the first of which is that it was their property. Since it was their property, had he taken it without permission, had he taken it in a time period where he wasn't allowed to take it, it would have been gezel, and you would not be successful at creating Kiddushin. So that's one of the dinim, that a stolen item can't be used to generate Kiddushin. Number two is, it's Shemitah. Shemitah makes the field Hefker, and therefore he takes possession of the items from Hefker, from Shvi'it, and then uses them for Kiddushin. That's the second thing, which is that you can use Perot Shvi'it to be Mekadesh and Isha. So that's the second din that you learn out. The third din you learn out is that what is coming up now, which is Avamar. And he said, took this basket full of figs and says, Hare kuchem mekudeshet li bekalkala zot. All of you women are married to me with this basket full of figs. V'kibla achat mehen ayidei kulan. One of them accepted it on behalf of all the others. So here's the third din that comes out of here, which is that a woman can act as a shliach, as a proxy emissary for other women in the acceptance of kiddushin, even in a situation where she will be a co-wife, even in a situation where the resultant acceptance makes her a co-wife, a tzara, to the other women, she can function both on behalf of herself to accept as well as on behalf of the other women. So those are the three dinim that we learn out from here. Amru chachamim, What is the result of this action that he took? Ein achayot mikudashot. The sisters are not successfully married over here, and that is because you may not have kiddushin with two sisters. If you do it b'zechar zeh, if you did it in a sequential manner, then the first of the sisters that you were mikadesh, you would be successful at. The second sister, which has a chiyum karet associated with it, would be a kiddushin that is in tofsin, and therefore you can't create kiddushin with the second sister. We have a principle that kol she'ein b'zechar zeh, anything that can't be accomplished sequentially, eino b'vat achat, can't be accomplished simultaneously. So since you couldn't marry the sisters in a sequential manner, over here where you do it simultaneously, it fails. So as far as the sisters are concerned, you did absolutely nothing because you can't marry the sisters. But now, as far as the other three women, it is achayotu dein mikudashot. The sisters you do not marry, hanachriot mikudashot. On the other hand, the three remaining women you are successful at marrying. Ve'amai. Why should that be the case? At v'chamor hi. It's the equivalent of at v'chamor. You're trying to generate kiddushin with five women. For two of the women, it fails, and the other three, it works. So here's a similar idea where you are in a single kinyan, creating kinyanim that some work and some don't work. So then what should be the din over here? Depending on your opinion before, according to Rav Sheshet, Kana Kol, you should be successful. According to Rav Amnuna, who says, Lo Amar Klum, seems wrong, because over here, you still are successful with the three women. And Rav Nachman, who says, Mechza, maybe over here you could suggest that the half that works is the three women that are successful in making Kiddushin with. The way that the Rashbam says it is, Ki Rav Sheshet. That this is a proof to Rav Sheshet, or this upholds the position of Sheshet. I just noted for you that it seemingly could even uphold the position of Rav Nachman. Although you could argue over here that Rav Nachman was talking about a case where you're talking about divisible property or two items. Over here where he gave a single basket, a single shliach. Maybe this doesn't qualify for Rav Nachman's case or position, and that's why the Rashbam doesn't mention Rav Nachman over here. But clearly, the fact that it succeeds should be a strong proof to Rav Sheshet. So Amarlei, Hainu dechazai Rav Huna bar Avya b'chalma. Rav Ashi responds to Rav Mordechai over here. That's why I saw it in my dream, Rav Huna bar Avya. The motive Rav Avya to Yufta. Because Rav Avya was going to ask a question, or we were going to get a question from Rav Avya in the Beit Midrash. So that's what the Rashbam says. The Rashbam says it was a fulfillment of the dream. He had a dream about Rav Huna bar Avya. He couldn't place it. He couldn't understand what it meant. Then all of a sudden now in the Beit Midrash, a question is brought up from Rav Avya. He says, now I know why I had the dream about Rav Huna bar Avya. Even over there, it was the son of Rav Avya. Over here it is Rav Avya himself asking the question. But maybe the Torah of the individual was like the child of the individual. Maybe that's why it is in the dream. Others suggest that it was just in a joking manner. He said, now I know why I had a dream about this. Because it wasn't meaningful. The question wasn't a strong question. As we're going to see in a second, he's going to dismiss the question. And so therefore, he doesn't think that it was meaningful. And in a joking manner, he says, now that's the dream I had about Rav Huna bar Avya. So he was making light of the question. So lav mi ukimna. Then we already qualify that statement over there. Damar haruya mikem libiya titkadeshli. The ones amongst you that are ru'uyim libiya should be married to me. There's a machloka between Abai and Rava as to whether kiddushin shalonim tsarim libiya. If one creates kiddushin, which in the end cannot be fulfilled through biya, but that is successful kiddushin. So an instance where you create a safek, or other instances or circumstances that the Gemara Kiddushin speaks about, the question is, can you create kiddushin where you can't fulfill the consummation of the marriage? Abai says it works. Rava says it fails. It happens to be one of the places that we paskin like Abaye. Over Rava, Yalkagam is the Kof, which is Kiddushim Shalonim Sarim the Biyah. That's one of the instances we paskin like Abaye. That's why the Gemara here brings only the solution of Abaye. Abaye's solution to that question or that Mishnah in Kiddushin is to say, Haruyam Ikem the Biyah Tidkadeshli. Those amongst you that are Ruyam the Biyah will have Kiddushin with me. So in that statement, now he never included the sisters to start with, so it's not a case of At v'chamor. Rav over there gives an alternate explanation, but the Gemara here brings Abaye's explanation because of the fact that halacha ke Abaye in that situation. So therefore, we tried twice to bring a proof to Rav Sheshet, or at least support the position of Rav Sheshet. And both times we rejected the proof to Rav Sheshit's position. And you can see here that the top Tosafot says, Rav Nachman Amar Kana Mechsa, V'Hilchata K'Rav Nachman. The Halacha is like Rav Nachman, and the Rishbam also says the same thing over here in the third of the wide lines. V'Abayehu D'Muki La'achi B'Kudushin V'Kaimelon K'Rav Nachman Da'at V'Chamor Kana Mechsa. We hold like Rav Nachman again that Ad V'Chamor you get half of it. V'Amezakelu Bar L'Kishiteleid Kana K'Rav Nachman. And in the previous sugya, where we also had this, had a three-way machloket, there too, the halacha is like Rav Nachman, which is that you cannot be mizakeh to an ubar, but if you say lekishetelei kana, then you are successful creating a kinyan, and this abides by the principle that generally in dinim, the halacha is kirav Nachman. Now the truth is that the supports that we brought for Rav Sheshet, we looked at them, they might actually be also in some ways helpful towards Rav Nachman as well. So even though we rejected the proofs towards Rav Sheshet, those were answers that at least tried to deal with it. But still, if you looked at it in the core that we're speaking, bringing these proofs and we're trying to knock them off by giving maybe dochak answers, in the end, it is supportive of Rav Nachman as well, not just the Rav Sheshet. And that would make it so that the halacha being like Rav Nachman is also maybe supported by these cases here as well. So now we move on to a new series of cases here, which is how the Amar Lo D'Debitu, person who says to his wife, my possessions, all of my possessions are to you and to the children. Amar Rav Yosef, how do we interpret the distribution of assets here when he says, my assets go to you and the children? So you might have read it, or the simplest way to read it would be, you guys split it evenly. There'll be five children and the wife, so you split it six ways and the wife will get a portion. Rioza says that's not the right way to look at it, but rather, kanta mechza. Anytime you have a delineation of two groups of individuals, Rav Yosef says that you split it evenly. Each one represents half of what is being given over here. Vamari Yosef minaminola. Where can I prove it to you? Where can I show you that I'm right? Daniel. We have a bright Rabbi Omer, Vaital Aron Upanav. It says there, when it comes to at the end of Parshat Emor, where it speaks about the Lechem Apanim, they will be the recipients of the Lechem HaPanim. It will be for Aaron and his children. Mechza le'Aaron, mechza le'banav. Half to Aaron, half to the children. So that has to do with how they split up the Lechem HaPanim. The Lechem HaPanim was split up between the Mishmar HaNichnas and the Mishmar Yotzei. The Mishnayot discuss or have a machloket about how exactly it's divided between the Mishmarot HaNichnasim or Yotzim. The breakdown of 7 and 5, or whether it's a breakdown of 6 and 6, the machloket about how it's distributed. But if the Kohen Gadol comes in and decides that he wants to take a portion, we have a rule that a Kohen Gadol gets primacy with regards to being makriv, any korban that he chooses to. He can supersede anybody else's rights. As well as with the distribution of the Kodeshim, he gets the first portion, or he gets a portion along with all the other Kohenim. So what's being said over here is that by Dalaron Banav, if he wants to take part in the eating of the Lechem Panim or take a portion of Lechem Panim, he'll get half, and then the other Kohanim will get half. So you see that when it's delineated as Aron versus Banav, a single individual versus a multiple number of individuals, we don't say that we look at that person as being one amongst the many. We don't say take Aron and his Banav and then split it up evenly between them. No, we say that you're offsetting. It's Aron or Banav. Half to Aron, half to Banav. And similarly over here, half to his wife, half to the children. And that's the proof that Rav Yosef brings. Amar le Abaye, Bishlama hotam Aron bar chalukahu. Over there, Aron, even as a Kohen Hedyot, would have rights of distribution of the Lechem HaPanim. It's only his extra rights as the Kohen Gadol that gives him more rights or excessive rights over there. Therefore, when the Torah goes out of its way to show you that Aaron is delineated versus the other children, then he gets half. Isha la bat Yerushahi. There is no default status of the woman here that she would inherit these possessions. It's enough that she should take like one of the children. If the Torah had said nothing with regards to Aaron, and just said that it belongs to the Kohanim, the Lechem HaPanim, Aaron would be entitled to split it with them as well, because he's also a Kohen. He's no less a Kohen than the Kohen Hedyotot, so he is also a Kohen, but he also happens to be a Kohen Gadol on top of that. So then when the Torah goes out of its way to delineate Aaron separately, he must be adding on to what he otherwise would have had. Otherwise, he would have had an equal distribution. Now you're saying give it to Aaron. That means he gets something more than an equal distribution. He'll get half. And then by the woman, it's much harder to say that. The woman herself has no rights in the Yerusha. Had he said nothing, it would have gone all to the children. Now when he puts the woman in the fray, maybe she should be on an equal playing field with the other children or the other Yoshim. He's just making her like one of the Yoshim. So it's not an upgrade from her current status. She had no status at all. He's putting her in the fray to start with. So who says that the cases are comparable? By her own, you're giving him an upgraded status from a person who already has rights. By the case of the woman, you're giving her a right to start with, and maybe those rights would limit her to being one among the many, rather than being mechza u'mechza. So he says, Ini, is that really the way that we would paskin? There was an incident in Arda, and Shmuel did something along the lines of what I said, which is split it 50-50. But Tveria, v'agbe Rabbi Yochanan palga, we had a similar incident in Tveria. Rabbi Yochanan also split it. So here you have Bavel and Eretz Yisrael. They're bringing cases from both locations. And you're saying that the Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan, who are the Gdolei Amoraim at that time, both paskin, like what I'm saying, Rabbi Yosef says, which is that it's 50-50 and not that she gets a portion amongst the many. Vitu, in addition to that, Kiyata Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef, Amar. So we have another story that's brought by Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef. How to make klila? There was the crown tax, the shadu be'malka a'abule va'estruge, that he placed upon the abule and estruge. These are obviously not your typical Aramaic words. They probably are either of Roman or Greek origin. Now, the way that the Rashbam translates it, he says that abule are the rich, v'estruge are the sarim, are the ministers. If you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he translates abule as b'nei a'ir, the members of the city, the citizens of the city, and estruge are the chatzranim. Sounds like the people who live in the chatzerot, or the people who live in the suburbs. So it's the city dwellers and the suburban dwellers. I would think you could see in the word here that estruge comes to the word strategic or strategy, and therefore the word estruge is used to reference to sarim, ministers, or even maybe somebody, appointment in the army, or somebody high up in the government, a government official. And abule may come from the word bull, which is also like a tax or a stamp tax that is used. And it's speaking about the wealthy or those individuals who are normally taxed because they have the money. So the way that the Rashbam explains it is that the king came along and said that you got to pay the crown tax, and it's coming out of the hands of the rich and of the government officials. Amar Rabbi, nitvu abule palga v'struge palga. The 50% of it should come from the abule, and 50% of it should come from the estruge. So there you see again, where the king demanded that they jointly pay for the crown tax, Rabbi thought that the distribution should be equal. You have two sets of parties that are being offset against each other. Like what Rabbi Yosef says and suggested to us, it should be a 50-50 split between them, and that's what Rabbi says. He says, how can you compare the cases? On the original order, or normally when the crown tax is imposed, a'abule ave katve, it is assigned to the wealthy individuals of the city. The expectation is that they are going to pay the crown tax. V'estruge ave misaye ba'adayu. And again, the assumption is that the estruge will pitch in or add in that way. So whether you think this is the Rabbeinu Chananel who says that, it's the city dwellers who are the primary payers of the tax, but the suburbanites help contribute, or they donate a portion of the tax payments. Or you think like the Rashbam, it's the imposition is on the wealthy with some help from the ministers or the government officials to pay the tax. V'yada malka davuka mesaye. And the king knows that that's how it's going to work. When he imposes the tax, he knows it's either going to be, according to Rabbeinu Gershom, on the city dwellers, or according to the Rashbam, on the wealthy. Hashto maika katve. So over here, when then he adds in additional language that says, abuli vastruge, why would he specify them in particular? The memra, dani palga, vani palga, that each one of them should share in 50% of the burden. This is very similar to the question that Abaye posed to Rabbi Yosef from the proof he brought from Aaron and Banav, which says that in the case of Aaron and Banav, Aaron already had underlying rights. Writing Aaron then, in this case, means that he must be giving him something more than he had before. Similarly over here, when it comes to the tax normally worked in a way where the abule paid and the estruge helped out or donated to it, and the king knows that. Now that the king goes and writes specifically that this crown tax will come from the abule and the estruge, What is he adding that we didn't know already? That's the way it's normally paid. So it must be that he's trying to tell you that something more than the normal manner, or this is different than the normal way that it's carried out. And that means, just like by our own, you're adding rights on top of his existing rights. So to here, for the Astruge, you're adding taxes above the normal taxes. They normally just helped out. Now he's saying, no, that they're going to have to pay a full 50%. So he's upgrading their status in the need to pay this tax. So in that case, you have, according to the Rashbam, that means that these ministers or these government officials have to pitch in, not just their donation or whatever they did, but normally they're going to have to give 50% of it. For the Rabbeinu Gershom, who says that it's speaking about the city dwellers versus the suburbanites, here the suburbanites can't just add in and give to the city. They're going to have to provide their whole 50% from their population. Well, there are others that say that Abuli Astruge means, Abuli means the rich, and Astruge means the poor. Then it would be the same idea over here as well, that the rich and poor would have to equally donate towards the crown tax. So then he says, again, this may not be approved to your position, Rav Yosef, because the situation or circumstance over here is there are existing protocols, and when you write something, you must be trying to change those protocols or say something in addition to what would be the default scenario. In the case of the woman and the children, there is no default scenario. The woman is out of the picture in the default scenario. So when you bring her back in, maybe over there, it's only to bring her in to be one amongst the many, not to give her 50% of the Yerusha. Meidei Rabbi Zera. Omer, Harei Alei Mincha Mei Yisrael Navi B'Shnei Kelim. I am going to bring a mincha that is of a size of 100 Yisrael in two different Kelim. Just as a matter of understanding, the biggest mincha that you can bring in the Mikdash is a mincha of 60 isaron. That's the maximum you can get. That is the principle that we know that is used all over Shas, which is that a reason that you're capped out at 60 is because up to 60 you can mix the mincha. The oil, the flour, and the water that has to be mixed together, they can be mixed together up to 60 isaron. Once you get beyond 60 isaron, it doesn't mix well, and therefore it's not considered to be a bila, a mixture, a mincha. And over there we get the principle, which is, who says that you're going to mix it at 60? Maybe if you can't mix it, it should be fine. Just like when, if you have 20 or 10, if you don't mix it, it's fine. And there we get the principle, which is, kosher ra'oy le'bila, anything that is okay and can't possibly be mixed, ain bila ma'akevet bo. Then the mixture doesn't hurt it. But anything that is ainu ra'oy le'bila, something that can't be mixed, bila ma'akevet bo, then the mixing ruins it or doesn't allow it to happen. So that means if you bring a mincha of 10 yisaron, even if you don't mix it, it is bidiavad okay, because you could potentially mix it. And then if you bring a mincha of 61 yisaron, so when you don't mix it, it's not because you didn't mix it, it's because you can't physically mix it, and therefore it is me'akev, the mincha. So here he says, I'm going to bring this large mincha of 100 yisaron and 2 kelim. He's compelled to do so because he's capped that at 60. Mevi shishim mikli achad v'arbeim mikli achad. He brings 60, which is the maximum in one kli, and then he brings the additional 40 in a second kli. So you see over here that the split is 60-40. Instead of what Rav Yosef would have said, shnei kelim, you should divide it up 50-50. You should bring 50 in one kli, 50 in the other kli. Why are you breaking it down into a 60-40 distribution in the bringing of the mincha? So v'emivi chamishim kli achad v'chamishim kli achad. If he does bring 50 in one kli and 50 in the other kli, yatsa, bidiavad, it works. Imevi, in. From there you would see that it works, bidiavad, the chadchil alo. But that's not the proper way to break it down. If you say that anything in this situation, palgo, palgo, whenever you say two kelim, two people, you delineate one against the other, you mean a 50-50 split. So to over here, afilu the chadchil anami. Here, even the Chathila, you should be able to split it at 50-50. So this seems to be a question on Rav Yosef's position, that anytime you offset items, you mean a 50-50 split. So Bali Tosafot say over here, what is the question? Tame of the Reed, Demai Kashule. V'chim pashut lo komer nechseh l'shnei b'nei adam. The person says that all my possessions go to two people. Shayu shavim. Everybody would agree that it'd go 50-50 in that case. Even so, when it comes to the mincha, he divided up 60-40. So why is this a question of Yosef? This is basic difference between a korban and the case of splitting assets between parties. And it's obvious that a mincha gedola is what the person intended for, and that's why there's this difference. So the Bali Tosafot say, and actually the question is the following, which is that even though logically we would have thought something, nevertheless the principle of Yosef comes and overrides. By the case of the women and the children, we would have thought that she should divide evenly with the children. Yet Rav Yossi still says split it 50-50. And that's the nature of the question over here. Even though the logic would dictate by the Korban that we meant to give the biggest Korban and therefore he should split it 60-40. Nevertheless, just like by the case of the women and the children, Rav Yossi says despite the logic we split it 50-50, so too over here by the Korban, maybe we should say the same thing. Even though he meant for a Korban Gadol, maybe the principle of Yosef overrides that logic and says you split it 50-50 anyway. And that's the nature of the question over here. Hachiashka, again, the cases aren't similar. Hotam anansade, we have a good sense, or we really can conclude, Dai Gavra mi kara the Korban Gadol kamikavin. He wants to bring the biggest Korban possible that he could bring. So then why did he break it down into two utensils? It's only the other lefshar, the tuyah b'kli echad. He knows or he realizes he can't bring it in a single kli. Kama de efshar l'tuyah matinan. Therefore, as much as he can, he wants to bring in one kli. This guy is trying to give a very large mincha, and trying to make a very large kurban to Hashem. So he wants to maximize the size. He realizes when he says 100 isaron, which is a very large size, he realizes that practically he won't be able to bring it as 100 isaron. But then when we break it down between the two kelim, we still want to get the ruach, or the spirit of his donation to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is that he wanted to get the biggest possible. The way that you do it is you maximize in one kli and give 60, and then residual you put on the other kli, rather than putting 50-50, but you don't get maximized out on any of the kelim. So again, here, it is a unique case, and therefore you can't compare it to the case of Rav Yosef, and it doesn't undermine his position. V'hilchata kavate de Rav Yosef. The law is like Rav Yosef, b'sadeh, inyan, u'mechsa. These three issues that come up in Masechet Baba Batra, the halacha is like Rav Yosef. Again, Akandaf Kufyu Dalid, when we had this previously, I discussed there the problems that are associated with this statement of the Gemara. Seemingly, Vehilchata would mean that somebody argues on Rav Yosef. So far, we haven't found anybody that argues on Rav Yosef in this sugya. Secondly, the other two cases that are brought here, the case of Sadeh and Inyan, those issues have a machlok between Rav Yosef and Rabbah. For instance, by Inyan, the machlok was when do you consider it to be leaving the Inyan and moving to the next Inyan? When is it considered to be closure to whatever you're working on? So over there, Rav Yosef said that it's considered to be moving to the next Inyan when goes Vancho Sukim Bote Inyan. As long as you're still in the topic, still dealing with the topic, it's considered that you are still involved and you can change the terms or you can deal with whatever it is. Rab over there argues on him and says, that's not the test for Inyan. The test is whether you stood up, you got up or not. If you're still seated, then it's considered to be one Inyan. Once you stand up, then it's considered to be something new. Over there we said the Lacha is Rav Yosef. So that's understandable. Rab and Rav Yosef are arguing. The Lacha is like Rav Yosef, especially since everywhere else in the Shas, Rab and Rav Yosef, the Lacha is like Rab. So here you're providing the exceptions to the rule. So two things. One is that the Baal Yad Tosafot back there, many of the Rishonim discuss whether this rule is a Shas applicable rule, or is this a Baba Batra applicable rule? That the Locha is always like Rabba versus Rav Yosef, with the exception of these three cases happen to all be in Baba Batra. So maybe it's saying only locally in Baba Batra is the halacha like Rav Yosef in these two cases, otherwise like Rabba. But in the rest of Shas, there might be other times where the halacha is like Rav Yosef. Or is this a Shas principle that says the halacha is always going to be like Rabba versus Rav Yosef, the exception of these three cases? So that we discussed back then. The second thing we discussed back then is the problem of this issue of Mechza. We pass by Rav Yosef, who's arguing on Rav Yosef to say a hilchata to Rav Yosef. So we saw back there that Abaye, who poses a question to Rav Yosef, Abaye was both a Talmud of Rabba and a Talmud of Rav Yosef. So what the Rishonim suggest is that the Gemara had a Misora that Abaye's question was the position of Rabba. Or he was bringing in the position of Rabba, because again, Abaye was a Talmud of both Rabba and Rav Yosef. So maybe there, when he posed the question of Rav Yosef, it was coming from Rabba. And that's why it says, over Hilchotu Gavate de Rav Yosef. Or the other possibility is it's just thrown together with the other items, because all of these are issues where the halacha is like Rav Yosef in Baba Batra. And so this is the third case, right? There's no argument over here, but it's included because in Baba Batra, these are the three instances where halacha is Rav Yosef. Not to say that there aren't other places in Shas where halacha is like Rav Yosef when he's not arguing on Rabba. So those are different ways to deal with this statement, or this global statement, about Hilchot Kavat Rav Yosef here, Bisadeh Inyan Umechsa. Mechsa is our case over here. When it's split, goes 50-50. Inyan is from moving from Inyan to Inyan. And then Sadeh is all the way back in the first parak on Daf Yud Bet, that a person who buys land on the border of his father's property does have a din of bar mitzvah when the property is close to other property that he's going to get or has. So those are the three cases where we say the halacha is like Rav Yosef. The Gemara says, how do the shadar piske de shirai the beite? If an individual sent home pieces of silk to his house, Ami Rabbi Ami, haruin the banim the banim, ruin the banot the banot. How do we divide up these pieces of silk? We look. Those that are appropriate for the men, we give to the boys. Those that are appropriate for the women, we give to the girls. Below Amran, el deleitle kaloto. That's only true if he doesn't have a daughter-in-law. Avalitle kaloto, le kalate shadar. If it was a daughter-in-law there, then he would give precedence to the daughter-in-law. So what exactly the scenario is here is unclear. It happens to be that the Rabbeinu Gershom says it's a case. Below Ayelo Isha. He didn't have a wife. Because if he had his wife, then if he sent silk back to the family, he obviously would give his wife precedence over the daughters. And therefore, if you're going to split it up between the male pieces of silk and the female pieces of silk, the female pieces of silk, obviously, he meant for his wife. So the Rabbeinu Gershom clarifies and says that there's no wife in the picture, and that's why it's going to the daughters and the sons. Others believe that that does not have to be the case. Even if he had a wife, he's still sending it for his children to use. Then, in terms of the division of the children, it gets split between the boys and the girls based on the nature of the silk, whether it's the color of the silk, the shape of the silk that was sent. We try to divide it up and say which would be appropriate for the boys, which would be appropriate for the girls. In terms of the girls, it says that he would give it to his daughters, even if they were married. But if he has daughters-in-law, then he would give precedence to his daughters-in-law over his own daughters. And that is because the responsibility of the daughters is in the hands of their husbands. Which means that in their day, when you got married, or the woman got married, she moved in with the family of her husband, or lived together with the husband's family. That's why many of the halachot with regards to avelut, issues of a kohen becoming tamei for his sister, once the woman got married, it's as if she moved to the other family. So, in terms of his own daughters, he would be less inclined to give them, even though they are blood relatives to him, than his daughters-in-law, because his daughters-in-law are living amongst the family or in the family compound, and his sons are responsible to take care of them. And therefore, it is more likely that the father-in-law would buy the silk for his daughters-in-law than his own daughters. It's an interesting mentality or psychology that was in their day, but probably as a result of the reality that the women who got married moved to the other family, and they were considered out of the house, versus the daughters-in-law who were part of the family and in the house. Today might it be the psychology or the way that people deal with this might be the opposite way around, which is that they would probably favor their daughters over their daughters-in-law. But at least back then, that was the way that people looked at it. And so therefore, they're trying to divide it. They're trying to understand what he would have thought, or what his intent was when he sent the gift. So again, if there's a wife there, according to Rabbeinu Gershom, she would take precedence. In the absence of a wife, according to others, even with the wife there, he's giving it or distributing it to his children, and we're trying to distribute it as best as possible with the intent of the gift that he sent. V'benate lo nisivan, lo v'shavak benate umishad lekalate. But if the daughters are unmarried, single daughters that are part of the household, he would definitely give them precedence over the daughters-in-law. So in terms of a hierarchy in the female range, he would give his single daughters first, then his daughters-in-law, and then his married daughters. So again, if we're looking as to how to divide it up, that'll be the priority by which we divide it up, depending on who is in the household. He says, all my possessions could go to my children. He only had one male child, but he happened to have a daughter as well. So when he says that all my possessions should go to my children, the word banai, what does he mean when it uses plurality of ben? Remember, in Hebrew, when you conjugate to the plural, it always conjugates in the male form. That means that even if you're speaking about females, you would still do it in the male form. So the word banim can be boys, or the word banim can also represent children, because it can mean boys and girls. And so therefore, that's what's unclear over here. When he used the word banai, did he mean my children, meaning my son and my daughter? Or did he mean, say, my sons, but he only has one son? So how do you deal with that? That's what the Gemara is asking. Mi karu inche libra banai. Do people call their only son my sons? Do you use the plural term to reference to that single son? Odilma lo karinche le bra banai. People don't call their only son my children or my sons. Ulamoshka le brata ba matana gati. And why did he use the plural? Why did he say banim? In order to say children and not sons. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand the meaning of his statement. When he said banai, does that mean children? And therefore it included the daughter. When he said banai, does it mean sons? Even though he had one son, somebody will refer to his son as sons in the plural form. Amar Abaye Tashma. I'll prove it to you. It says, Uvnei Dan Hushim. Hushim was the only child of Dan, and it says, Uvnei. The children of Dan were Hushim. So you see that you do use the plural form, even when you have only one child there. So Amar Rova, Dilma Kedetana Bechizkiya. Who says that over there, Hushim really refers to just as his only child? But rather, Shayu Mirubim Kechushim Shel Kaneh. Rather, it is a play on the word. The word is not his real name, but rather a nickname indicating that they were like multitudes, like the Hushim of the Kaneh. Over here, you have a number of explanations that are brought down. The Rashbam over here brings that the Hushim of the Kaneh are either bushes of the reeds, which is that they grow in a dense situation where you have tons of reeds coming up from a single point. Or he says it's like a very long reed where they have knots along it. It's like all the knots along the reed. The Rabbeinu Gershom also brings two different interpretations. He says that he had robanim keotan sirtutim shel kanim sheish pekanim shenarukot, that these are like the lines or the markings that are along a very long reed. So whether that means like what the Rashbam says, the knots that are along the way, or it means that there are vertical stripes in it. And some say kealim shel kaneh, like the leaves of the reed, shein klipot harbe zuagavzu, that they have multiple levels of leaves on top of them. But anyway, the basic idea is that Hushim is not really his name, rather representing what will come from him, which is that Hushim will have large families, or they'll have large numbers that come from them. The Baal Tosafot asks, that's true in the future, that's not true right now. Mikomakom nikrakeno shema atid. He used this, or he was called this, because of his future, or what he would bring in the future. And therefore, the use of the term ubnei might be appropriate over here, because kushim does not really represent one person, but rather the one person who is going to become a large multitude that comes forth from him. Elo Amarova, I can bring it from here. Ubnei falu Eliav. Again, he used the term ubnei in plural, and it's referring to his only son, Eliav. Rav Yosef Amar, you can do it from here. It says, ubnei Eitan Azariah. So again, a single son, but yet it's prefaced with ubnei. So now, that would indicate that when you use the plural term, you'd mean not son and daughter, not children, but rather sons, but sons reference to that single son that you have. He says, all of my possessions are to my children. Avalei bra, ubar bra. The only descendants that he had were a child and a grandchild. So now, kari inshe the bar bra bra. Do people call their grandson their child? Although, or maybe not. So again, he used the plural term, but he only has one son. What did he mean by that? Did he mean his son and his grandson? Or did he mean just his son when he used the plural term for sons? So it could be either the grandchild of the son that we're speaking about, and he just wants to forward him the Yerusha over and above his father. Or it might have been another son that had passed away, and this is the child of that son. Rav Chivya says that people do call their grandson a son. Mar Bar Vashi Amar Lo Kara Inshe the Bar Bara Bara. People do not call their grandson a son. Tanya Kavata de Mar Bar Vashi. We have a brayta that supports Mar Bar Vashi. Hamudar Hana Abi Banim. Someone who takes a neder, we won't get any benefit from his children. Mutar B'Bnei Banim. He is mutar when it comes to grandchildren. So B'Lashon B'Nei Adam, people do not conflate the terms of children and grandchildren. When they say children, they mean children. And not grandchildren. Although that is true in Lashon B'nei Adam, in the colloquial speaking, there are still halachot where that is not true. And that we say that B'nei Banim, Hariyem Kibanim, that principle does stand by Piriya or Rivya. When it comes to reproduction, the grandchildren have a status like children, and therefore a person is Mekayim the mitzvah Piriya or Rivya through grandchildren, not just through children. That is nafkaminos if the children pass away, or if a person only has male children or female children, and then has the opposite gender as a grandchild, that could fulfill his need in terms of Piriya Rivya. So there is a case where B'nei Banim, Hariyem Kibanim, But that is not when we're speaking in the colloquial, when people are taking the darim. Or a person is gifting, there when they say the term son, they do not mean grandson. Right, so the Mishnah says, Heniach banim gedolim uktanim. If after the father passes away, there are children that are left, some of which are of age, some of which are still ktanim, are still minors. So the Balei HaTosafot point out that it doesn't have to be that situation, but it's just talking about what would be a orcha demilta. This is a normal situation in which this issue would arise, but the same is true even if you have gedolim and gedolim. If the gedolim went ahead and improved, appreciated the value of the estate, then that value accrues to everyone. The estate is still viewed as being intact, and therefore when they appreciate or they do things that cause the appreciation of the estate, that accrues to all the parties of the estate. And in essence, the ktanim over here will be the beneficiaries of that which the gedolim are doing. Im amru, if they say, re'u masheniach abba, see what our father left us, hare anu osim ve'ochlim, and therefore we're going to work on our own stuff and do it for our own benefit, hishbichu datzman, the benefit or the accrual will all go to them. So first of all, the Rashbam points out that they have to do this, and he gives a list of options as to whom they are saying this in front of. Bifnei edim, omru the beitin, o betzibur. They either go in front of witnesses, or to the court, or to the public at large and say, basically, we want to split up the estate. We want to break it down now. You need to get an executor for the estate for the minors here. And we want to have our own possessions so that we can work with our possessions and appreciate our own possessions. And then, nitatzlu, beitin. Beitin just didn't get around to it or didn't take care of it. So they've made a declaration which says that we want to divide the assets. Obviously, they want to do it in a fair manner and they want to abide by beitin. But beitin just doesn't get around to it, took their time with it, and they don't end up splitting the assets. In that case, the Mishnah says that if they work for the estate and they cause appreciation in the estate, that value accrues to them personally and not to the estate as a whole. The Balei HaTosafot bring from the Tosefta that it is Bifnei Beitin, only Bifnei Beitin that they make this declaration, although they do acknowledge that which the Rashbam says, and they don't really understand why the Tosefta limits it to Beitin. It should be in any sense where they're making it clear and obvious that they want to divide up the assets, and that the ikuv, the delay in doing so, is not because of them. That's number one. Number two is, the Rashbam says, once they do this, and they improve the value of the estate, then the property that is theirs, that or accrual, will accrue to them. So that means that when they work on the estate and they create profits, they'll get the allocated profits that are associated with their property. The Balei HaTosafot ask on that, I don't understand. It says, the Rashbam seems to say, Mashmash rotzeh lomar, she'enosh biach el mechoko amagiyo, that he will only get the value of the appreciation and the portion that belongs to him, ve'en elo shevach amagiyo lechelko, and he only gets that, ve'en nira. He says, that doesn't make so much sense, for a number of reasons, one of which is, that's what he was going to get anyway, which is that even if he appreciated the whole estate, and we said it all went to the middle, then, in that case, when they divide up the estate, he would get the appreciation associated with his particular property. I think you can argue, or you could say, that it's in a situation where, if it was the emtza, even if he only worked with a particular parcel of land or a particular allocation of the estate, we would then distribute those profits across the entirety of the estate. Over here, he's allowed to keep those profits allocated or connected to his particular property, and he doesn't have to spread them across the value of the entire estate. That's the way the Rashbam learns. The Balei HaTosafot disagree and say, Valkein Nira Lari, Kepeirish Rivam, that the Rivam's explanation here makes more sense. There are two Rivams in the Balei HaTosafot. One of the Rivams is actually the Rashbam's brother, who is Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Meir, because the Rabbeinu Tam, who's a much younger brother of the three brothers, couldn't take on the name or the acronym Rivam, because his older brother Rabbi Yitzchak already had it. So Rabbi Yaakov, Rabbi Meir, couldn't be the Rivam, it would be the Rivam the second. So that's why he ended up being Rabbeinu Tam. But his older brother was the Rivam, and the Rashbam and the Rivam are closer in age, because the Rabbeinu Tam was much younger, and the Rashbam was actually his teacher for much of his life. But it could be that this is the Rivam who is arguing on his brother, the Rishbam. The Shevach Shishbiach Mikol Nechasim Havishalo. That the entire accrual of benefit to the entire asset base belongs to him. So that's wild. He's suggesting now that after they ask for division of the assets, if they continue to work with all the assets and create improvements and value to all the assets, all of that value accrues to them. Nothing will go to the other children. Nothing will go to the minors. He says, "Velo dummy," and it's not similar to the case of Yorei the Tokhsadei Shechavero Shelo Birshut, that if a person goes down without permission to his friend's property and works on it and improves it, She'en lo ela schar tircho ima yitziah, all he can charge for is cost or the lower cost and benefit. O shutaf. Or in a case we have partners, Shavi Yorei Birshut, when he goes down to work the entire partnership, then he can demand payment for the 50% of the partnership that he doesn't own. He can demand payment like a sharecropper. The reason that that is true in those cases is because the owner of the property or the other partner could have created that value themselves. They could argue, listen, if you didn't do it, we would have done it and we would have created the value. So you can't come along and say that all that value belongs to you, because had you not done it, we would have done it. Yes, you're entitled to costs if you did it without permission. If it was a shutafa partnership, yes, you get a management fee. You get some sort of value out of this, but you can't keep it all. Velo machli, and therefore they are not mochel on that portion. Avahacha, im agdolim lo yarvichu. In this case, if the gdolim didn't do anything with the assets of the estate, haktanim lo yarvichu behem. The ktanim also would not benefit. The ktanim have no capacity to do anything here to generate profits. Beit Din is out of the picture because they didn't take care of the situation. There's no executor to the estate. So the Ktanim have no claim on the appreciation. All they can say is you used our principle to create appreciation. The brothers can say, if we didn't do that, you would still have me in the same situation. You couldn't have created that value. And therefore, the Bali Tosafot say, it's pretty amazing, that they can take the entire assets of the estate, generate profits, and keep all those profits for themselves, and not share it with the other brothers. Tosafot then says, this whole thesis is premised on the fact that the Yitomim are mochel, that the youngsters or the minors are mochel. But we know that Yatmei Lavnei Mechilaninu. Yitomim can't be mochel because they are ktanim. We can't have people who are ktanim waive rights. They don't have the understanding, they don't have the capacity to waive rights over here. Hacha de'im afsidin, lo b'yubi yadam ha-revach, machlei shapir. He says that Mechila comes when we're talking about losses or taking items away from them. There we say that the Yitomim can't be mochel, and therefore you can't do that. But over here, all it is foregone profits. The Michila, what are they being mochel? They don't have any rights technically to the profits. Their property is being used, but it's used in a way which they lose nothing. So that would enter the possibility that if there is depreciation, or if they cause losses here, that the older brothers might be responsible for that loss to the estate, and repay out of the profits the losses that are generated to the principal because of that. That's how Tosafot explains it. Again, it's a big, much bigger chiddush than what the Rashbam is saying. The Rashbam is just simply saying that he gets to allocate his property and then make profits on his property. Here, the Tosafot says he can use the entire estate, generate profits, and keep all those profits for himself as long as he doesn't cause losses or any detriment to the other parties in the estate. So that's the nature of the Mishnah. And now we have a second case in the Mishnah, which is with regards to a woman that the Gemara tomorrow will explain. B'chenisha, shpichat ha-nechasim. A woman who takes over the estate and creates profits or value in the estate. Hishbicha le-emtza. All of that profit goes basically to the Yitomim, because she is doing it without a division of property, and therefore she's working for the estate. She says, look what my husband left for me. So again, the same idea that she's asking for the allocation of the properties to be done, and it doesn't get done. I'm going to take care of my own property and eat off of my own property. Basically, I'm going to keep my ma'aseh yadayim for myself. Then she keeps the profits for herself. So again, over here, you'd have the machloket between the Rashbam and the Tosafot, exactly what she keeps here. The Rishbam has a qualifier in this, and he says, "V'hu de lo shakla mizonei." It's as long as she doesn't take mizonot out of the estate. Because there is a quid pro quo that if she takes mizonot, food out of the estate, then she gives her Masa Yadayim into the estate automatically. And that means that if she's taking Mizonot out of the estate, even if she declares she wants it divided up, then the mere fact that she's taking Mizonot subordinates her Masa Yadayim to the benefit of the estate. And therefore, if anything she does belongs to the estate because she hasn't separated herself out completely. She's taking Mizonot. Those Mizonot mean the Masa Yadayim belong to the Yatomim. That's the case when she creates accruals and benefits towards the estate. All of that will belong to the Yatomim because her Masa Yadayim belong to the Yatomim, even despite her declaration over here. We'll see tomorrow's daf again. The Baalei Tosafot don't agree with this position necessarily of the Rashbam. Now, the Gemara qualifies the statements of the Mishnah. Amar Rav Chaviva, Brei de Rav Yosef, Brei de Rova, Mishmei de Rova. So here we have a list of individuals who are bringing this memory in the name of Rova. Lo shanu elisha shibchu nechasim machmat nechasim. It's only true if the improvement to the estate came out of the estate assets themselves. So in order to generate the benefit, they use the assets of the estate and use money from the estate in order to generate the profits. So when do we say it goes to emsa? When do we say it belongs to all the parties? Again, where they didn't ask for it to be divided up. Is in a case where the investment to generate those profits came out of the estate as well. About shibchu nechasim machmat atzman, on the other hand, if the value or the monies to produce the profits came from they themselves, hishbichu atzman, then the value is theirs. They generated the value by investing their own money, so then the value will accrue to them. The estate can't make a claim on that value if the estate wasn't the investor that generated that benefit. The Rashbam here brings examples. Lo tirchu v'lo tziu mishalem klum. In the case where they didn't expend any money, elam nikse avihem, from their father's profits estate, they hire workers. And the workers planted and did whatever it is to improve the value. On the other hand, machmat atzmam is shechafru v'natu. They dug, they planted with their own sweat, v'sachru mishalehem, or they hired workers with their own money, v'lo mishalavim, as a shevach le'atzman. Then it all belongs to them. And as the Baalei Tosafot point out, that the implications of what the Rashbam are saying is, because they didn't notify the Yitomim or the Beit Din or whoever it is about the fact that they really wanted to split it up, therefore they are mochel on that which they contribute over here. He says over here, Mashmash Ratzalomar, the time of the Kemen Shesachru Mishalavim, Hayula Emta. Because they use the hiring out of the estate itself, it belongs to the estate. Diavamri Gdolim, Rau Mashaniachlan Ovinu, Haya Ovek Tanim, Akrovim, Maskrim Lam Polim, Mishalavim, Bishfilam. Because had they notified the group that they wanted to split it up, and then they went and used the assets of the estate to improve, then the defenders or the advocates of the miners would have come in and done the same thing and hired workers to do the same thing out of the assets of the estate. This is Tosafot, the Shita Del before says, if you can replicate the profits, then you can demand the profits. So in this case, that's what's happening. Since they did not tell them that they wanted to split it up, they're mochel everything to them, to the group as a whole or to the estate as a whole. Because had they changed the situation and declared it, someone would have come in and brought improvements or done the same improvements for the benefit of the children. They could have hired the same workers out of the monies of the estate, the same way that the older brothers did that. And so in that case, the older brothers can't make a claim on the value that was created. Now, when you're talking about when they put their own sweat and work into it, there you can understand why they can't make a claim against them and say, oh, we could have done our own sweat and work. They couldn't have done it. But with regards to hiring of workers, there you can make a declaration, which is, had you not done this, then we would have entered the fray on behalf of the Ktanim and made sure that they got the same benefit or hired out of the estate, because you didn't put in your personal money. You didn't do anything that we couldn't have replicated over here. And so that's how the Tosafot helps to explain the Rashbam. So now the Gemara continues and says, Ini, is that really true? If their father only left them over in Odiani, the way that the Rashbam explains it is, bor v'chisuyav. It was a watering hole with its cover. And they hire it out, or they rent it out for people to water their fields from that. So they own this watering hole that has a profit generator that they can hire out to other people in order to garner benefit or wages that come into the estate. Haschar le'emtza. Over there, all the profits go to the estate as a whole. Now over here, you have to work in order to do that. Someone who is going to take care of this and manage this property in order to generate value to the estate, that means that they're putting personal effort into it. So why is it, v'ha ojani d'machmat atzmohu? The case of ojani is a case where the individual brothers are working towards the generation of that value. Where it says, shaini ojani d'l'nituruta'hu davida. By the ojani, it doesn't take much to manage it. If you're speaking about managing something actively, digging, planting, working, that's something where you can say that I generated the value from myself and not from the estate. Over here, the only thing you need to do is sit by the boar and make sure people pay you before they take the water. In essence, you have to be a shomer. It's a very passive job. And therefore, the Gemara says, "Vafilu tanim nami matzu minterela." Even the miners could do this job. They could sit there and just make sure nobody takes water unless they pay for it. So since they could have done it just as well as the brothers, we don't consider this to be a personal investment whereby they should garner the benefits of those profits. The Balei Tosafot just note over here that Odianu, they say that Perisha Kuntris, they bring what the Rashbam brings. So the Ein Nira L'Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam disagrees with his brother and says that that's not the meaning over here. Ella, Mifereshu Kli Gavoa. It's a tall type of, I would call it either ladder or it's a lookout. Shomdim alav shomrei sadot ukramim. The people guarding the fields and the vineyards climb up on it in order to be able to see afar, to look out, and to guard the fields. The roads may alav lemerchok v'gamu ra'oy liyashen alav. And you can also sleep up there. It's a like a watchtower that's there that comes and seems like it's movable in some ways. And they rent out the watchtower, or they have this watchtower by which they can watch the fields and they get paid for it. So again here, the Gemara is saying, you would have thought that the wages garnered through that should accrue to the benefit of the person who does it. Gemara says in the end, it's not such an involved job. It's something by which anybody could do it. Even the Ketanim could be in this lookout tower, and they could do the work that was associated with being a shomer, chase away the animals, make sure people don't take from the fields. That can be even done by the Ketanim, and therefore, the value created here accrues to the whole estate, not to those particular individuals who do the work in this instance. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Mem Dalet Amud Aleph.